Candlelight by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 4. One who could have been a friend chuntered along the concrete-carpeted corridor. Breath coming in short, sharp gasps, he propelled his rotund body around the stone pillars to come to a stop before a door hidden in a dusky alcove. Panting, he stood a moment to regain his breath. Then, with a stubby finger, he stabbed at the bell push. Inside the apartment behind the door, a bell clanged noisily. Inside the apartment, the old man rested upon his bed. Sunlight streamed down upon the harbor waters. Down by the children's wading pool, fond mamas gazed protectively at the end product of their amatory efforts. On the branch of a nearby tree, a bird stood and sang of the joys of nesting time. The day was warm, cheerful, without a cloud in the sky. The bell clanged, the sound of the door being opened. Muttered voices, "Can I see him a moment? It is urgent." The clatter of footsteps, and one who bustled beamingly into sight around the corner. "Have you read this?" he squeaked, brandishing a copy of a very sensational French-language weekly. "It's all about you. Libelous. Scandalous. They are going to write a book about you. Why don't you do something about it?" The light of the sun gave no more warmth. A chill came to the air and a darkness crept over all. No more was the day gladsome. From the crumpled paper came the sinister emanations of hate, the hate of jealous men, a hate that had continued throughout many years, the hatred from authors whose books were not selling so well. Hatred, jealousy, concentrated venom against one who spoke and wrote the truth. One who fidgeted with his hat and looked as though he were having second thoughts about imparting his information. "You don't like the press at all, do you?" he queried. "The French language lot seems to be writing quite a bit about you, and on TV, too. Last night, a book critic held up your latest book, and he said he could not even read the first page of the first chapter, and then he launched into a bitter attack on you personally. I wondered how he could attack so much if he had not read the book." The old man sighed. "Yes," he replied, "there is a certain very noisy minority who are trying to harm not merely me, but the special work which I'm trying to do. But never mind what a critic says. He's just a person who lacks the brains to write his own book, and he's jealous of anyone who does. They confuse vicious sarcasm for wit. Don't bother about them." "But there must be something in it," said one who, "or the press would not keep on so. There's no smoke without fire." The old man snorted with indignation. "Shows how little you know," he said, "or you would not make such stupid statements." For a time, he lay upon his bed just thinking of the past, thinking of the events of a decade and a half ago. In those days, he'd been living in London, England, and since the publication of the first book, there had been difficulties. An agency in Switzerland had put a wholly misleading advertisement in the Times, reading, If Love Sang Grandpa will communicate with blank, he will hear something to his advantage. So, Love Sang Grandpa, scenting a trap by intuition, got an agent who was then Mr. Brooks of A.M. Heath and Company to get in touch with the advertiser to see what that was all about. It was very informative. The agency admitted they were doing wrong, but said they had instructions from an author in Germany to find out all. Well, during those days, the old man had been followed about, spied upon, and his life had been made a misery. During those days, Buttercup came to live with him and Mrs. Rampa. She came to live as an adopted daughter. Later, she was to come to Canada as an adopted daughter. But prurient-minded people immediately saw sexual perversions in such an arrangement, perversions which, in actuality, did not exist. The young lady was accepted as a full member of the family, as an adopted daughter. But, of course, people with filthy minds could not accept such a statement. The family left England, the land of persecution, and went to Ireland, to the beautiful little village of Howth, near Dublin. There they made some very good friends indeed, and still have those very good friends. But, spurred on by a lot of lies, the press mounted a campaign of hatred and incorrect statements against Love Sang Grandpa, saying all sorts of things, all sorts of untrue things. The stories they invented were far more miraculous than the absolute truth which Love Sang Grandpa told. One day, a whole horde of beastly-minded British reporters descended upon the formerly peaceful village of Howth. They shattered the peace, they upset everyone, and one reporter in particular stole a garbage bin outside the Rampa house, ransacking it for anything he could find, and then threw it in someone else's garden, complete with all the garbage. Fantastic, ferocious articles appeared in the English press and in the German press, which was acting in close collusion with the English reporters. Love Sang Grandpa was not able to do anything about the matter because he was ill in bed with severe coronary thrombosis. It was thought he would not live, but the press seemed to hope that he would not live because that would have added to the sensation. Pressmen came to the house. They yammered at the door like mindless creatures, seeking only that which was evil, and not finding it, they invented it. Mrs. Rampa was told they didn't want the truth. She was told what they wanted was sensation. The reporter-in-chief swore that he would not stop the publication of any other book by Love Sang Grandpa. This is the 14th. And he seemed to be beside himself with insensate fury. The whole point of the matter was, though, that because of illness, because of extreme illness, almost to the point of death, Love Sang Grandpa could not bring a law case for libel, and because that opportunity had been lost, the press of the world now seem able to quote whatever they like from the original articles published in England and in Germany. Apparently, because no case was made within a certain time, it cannot be made now. The British press were filthy. The German press were full of outraged indignation. But why? They worked themselves into insane fury without cause, because the Rampus story is perfectly true, and the whole family has, without any exception whatever, affirmed that the whole thing is true. Lobsang Rampa is who he claims to be. One particular reporter printed a report saying that Mrs. Rampa had confessed. It is not so. She had nothing to confess. This story is true. Lobsang Rampa is all that he has claimed to be. He can do all the things he writes about, but because through illness he could not go to court and defend his reputation, now the press, like insensate morons, copy the original false articles and add to them out of a perverted imagination. The French language newspapers seem to derive a high delight out of what they imagine was the sexual aspect of it, quite oblivious of the fact that there was no sex connected with the affair. It was all a completely innocent, completely pure association between two women and one man who lived as a hermit. The old man thought of all these things. He thought of the difficulties which had been made, not merely for him, but for those who would come after, those who would also try to help this troubled world. He thought of the time of another press attack. Lobsang Rampa was living in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Unknown to him, in California, in the U.S., a man was claiming to be T. Lobsang Rampa. He was trying to collect disciples, and he was encouraging them to take mescaline and peyote, saying it was good for their psychic development, etc., etc. And that Lobsang Rampa, without any exception whatever, has said that drug-taking is absolutely harmless. But Lobsang Rampa was in Windsor, Ontario, and the false Rampa was in Los Angeles. Inevitably, the Los Angeles fraud was reported in the press, and there was a great commotion about it. Eventually, it was proved that Lobsang Rampa was not in California, and the uproar died down. But the press did not at any time publish an apology or state that a mistake had occurred. The old man turned over on his bed and rustled some papers. Quite by chance, he came up with three or four letters. Glancing at them, his thoughts ran on. 2 or 3 months ago, letters began to come in. Where are my books? Where are the books you promised me? A mystified Lobsang Rampa couldn't make head or tail of it, until eventually there came a letter from Colorado saying that in the high part of Colorado there was a man living in a cave announcing publicly that he was T. Lobsang Rampa. He was telling people to drink intoxicating liquors and take whatever drugs they fancied. It was good, he said. He also advised people to write to headquarters, and they would be sent a free set of the Rampa books. Hence the mail which descended on Lobsang Rampa, then living in Montreal. An aroused Lobsang Rampa got in touch with the police in Colorado and applied quite a bit of pressure to the chief of police, pointing out What a bad advertisement it was for American justice if frauds could continue like this. So again, another impostor was stopped. There have been many such cases. The old man thought of the time when he had had letters from airline hostesses thanking him for the promise of the books and asking, where were they? Further letters produced the information that an impostor had been aboard a plane on their flight and had made quite a lot of ostentatious publicity. The fellow had said that he was Lobsang Rampa. He was going about with a lot of flair, a lot of bounce, saying how wonderful he was, promising free books for all, but not coming up with the books. And then hostesses and others writing in revealed the whole trickery. The press never takes such things into consideration. They never consider that people, like a horde of midges, persecute those of whom they are jealous. And so it is that the press actually help those who are evil. The press, it seems, will only give publicity to bad and never to good. They do nothing to correct a wrong. It seems, the old man thought, that in my case they have really gone overboard with their hatred, with their bias. They have quoted from my books, they have quoted from articles attacking me, and when complaint has been made, they say, oh, it's in the public domain, there's nothing you can do about it, we're within our rights. The television stations have been just as bad. There was, for example, a call some time ago from a television station. They issued an invitation. Come on, television, they said. Tell us the story. Tell us the truth behind the Rampa story. So I was going to, say, yes, the story is true. The Rampa story itself is true. It tells the whole story. Nothing more, nothing less. But they would not let me give my story. They insisted that instead I should read a prepared script, and that I refused because they wanted me to say I was a fake. But I am not. I am genuine. And that is why I could not appear on television. There have been other cases like this. I have been given absolutely wonderful guarantees that I could write or say whatever I liked. Put your own story over, they said. Come on TV, say what you like, we won't stop you. But as soon as an offer is taken up, no, they don't want the truth. They only want that which is sensational, and only that which is untrue, only that which panders to the worst emotions of mankind. Hence, throughout these books, I have attempted to get at least one message over, and one message in particular is, all that I have written is true. My books are true, and they contain my own experiences. But one who was puttering around, fiddling with his feet, twiddling with his fingers, you ought to do an article yourself, you know, he said. Why not tell the press your side of the story? You know a man who's connected with the press. Why don't you call in Mr. Telly? He'd be glad to publish just as you tell your story. Sure, I can make the arrangements for you. I know him well. He'll come along. You'll find he's easy to get along with. Will you do that? The old man thought about it. He thought about the article in the crummy French-language newspaper and then reaching a sudden decision, he said, "Yes. Tell the fellow to trot out his questions. Bring him along here. I'll give him an earful." So, one who smiled benignly, turned on his heel and trotted out. The family came in, took one look at the old man's glum face, and said, "Oh dear, more trouble? Is there never any end to it?" But what is truth? What is your conception of truth? Do you know truth when you see it? How would you assess the truth of a statement? Would you prefer to accept the word of a person who can demonstrate truth? Or would you prefer to accept the word of people like press reporters who just want something which is sensational? But of course, not only the press people are at fault. The public are at fault also, because just within the past few weeks, I've heard of an absolutely authentic case of a man in the USA. This man had what he believed to be the right idea. He wanted to bring good to the people, so he started a newspaper devoted to good, devoted to the better aspects of the daily news. And now the paper has closed down. People do not want to hear good news. They only want to hear bad news. People do not want to hear how well a person has done, but they are interested only in the bad things. Many people are now trying to pull down Churchill and others of that immense stature because it makes them feel great to find out something about Churchill. It doesn't matter if it's something true or false. If it's repeated enough, people will believe it. But let me tell you what I think about truth. In this day and age, when 14-year-olds complain they cannot communicate with even 16-year-olds, we must define our terms so that the reader can understand what the writer is trying to say. What is truth? Truth, as I see it, is a statement of facts, things which have occurred, things which are not the figments of an imagination, but the quality or state of being in accordance with experience, in accordance with that which actually occurred. That is truth. Precisely. That describes my books exactly. The quality of being in accordance with experience. I experienced all that which is written in my books. Wherefore, it is that I write truth. Imagination, conversely, is the act or power of creating mental images of that which has never been actually experienced. My powers of cerebration are not those which would enable me to write fiction. My astrological makeup absolutely inhibits such a display of cerebral virtuosity, wherefore it is that I am compelled to write only the truth. Let me repeat myself a little, even at the risk of some ill-natured person writing to me to say, "You told us all that before." People do write in such a manner, you know. So many people are wholly unable to understand the viewpoint of others. They have never had any experience themselves, and so they just like to be vicious and, as I said before, pull everyone down to their own miserable level. Every so often there is a silly season in the press. There's not much news about a war has ended, or the latest sex symbol has gotten married or has died or something else, and so bored reporters react to bored editors, made irate by idleness, by hatching up some scandal which really does not exist in fact. Sometimes some poor, wretched schoolteacher is accused of a heinous crime and is pilloried on hearsay evidence for something of which he is quite innocent. Having been framed, accused, judged, and condemned by the vicious press of England and Germany, with papers in other countries copying it, I'm going to give some details about it. Because, as you will have read in the foregoing pages, the press is still attempting to execute me, as they have attempted unceasingly during the past 15 years. In my innocence, I thought that every person accused of something had the right to be confronted by his accuser. I thought that every person had the right to defend himself. But, and I say this to you very seriously, the press have, without exception, refused to allow me to give my side of the story. They have refused to allow me any opportunity of defending myself. It's like some big bully with a high-powered public address system trying to shout down a person who can only whisper. Okay, I'm whispering to you. Will you listen? I am an author who really had no intention of becoming one. In England, many years ago, I tried, without any success at all, to obtain employment. I was too old, or too different, or too this, or too that. I went, as you can read in my books, to employment agencies and to all manner of strange places, all without success. Then I was given a personal introduction to see an author's agent who, it was said, might have something useful. Well, the agent, no doubt with an eye to profitable business, refused to give me a job, saying, "I've heard about you. Write a book about your own life." I left his office in disgust, and I admit, with considerable anger, because once again, I'd been brought on a fool's errand. Nothing was further from my mind than book writing. I thought that it was such a silly sort of thing. Unemployment and the hunger which it caused prevailed, and eventually, with extreme reluctance, I wrote a true book about my life. A true book. I bared a past which I very much wanted to conceal. I bared it, and I wrote about it so that I could eat. But there was jealousy. The fact that I was a success aroused the ire of certain people with much money, and, to put it bluntly, I was framed and attacked. When, through serious illness, I was quite unable to defend myself. No one has ever been able to prove me a fraud. For every expert who claimed that I was such, three or more attested to my complete genuineness. I was never accused before a court of law. Instead, there's only been the sickening innuendos of the press and others. innuendos which I could not refute at the time because of coronary thrombosis. The press, the television stations, and the radio have consistently refused to give my side of the story. They have refused to print or transmit my statement that all my books are absolutely true. Instead, they keep on hatching up a rehash of the whole affair, adding lies to lies, until in the end, one just does not know what is what. I am reminded of the person of whom I've just told you, the man who started a good newspaper and whose venture failed because people prefer scandal, people like doing harm to others. The press know that if I should prove myself absolutely true, then it would not help their circulation. Only scandal and murder and rape, etc., is a useful commodity to the press. People like to say, "Oh yes, I know it's true. I read it in the paper. I read it in the press." It's a case of give a dog a bad name and hang him before he can say anything in his defense. In my case, this attitude really has caused much harm. I had hopes of being able to help Tibet by speaking before the United Nations, and in fact, I claim that my books have helped Tibet and the cause of Tibet enormously, because my remarks have made the country known. My remarks have made the strange people human. Yet, in spite of the help I could give, some of the exiled high officials in India have said unkind things about me because, I understand from a reputable source, they have been told to discredit me or lose the help given by certain religious organizations. It may be asked, how can these spiritual leaders, so-called, discard one of their own? But Chairman Mao and General Chiang Kai-shek are both Chinese. Both try to discredit the other. Even here in Canada, where I now live, Mr. Stanfield tries his utmost to discredit Mr. Trudeau. Or old Tommy Douglas chirps in and tries to discredit everyone else. It seems to be an occupational hazard. But let's look at another case. In Northern Ireland, Christians kill each other because two sorts of Christians each think that only they are right. Both sides are Irish. Both sides are Christians. Both sides appear to believe in the same things, yet they fight and kill each other, and the press, by inflammatory reporting, add fuel to the flames. If good Christians behave like this, is it not understandable that Tibetans in India, under considerable political and religious pressure, may, under orders, repudiate one of their own elsewhere for the greater good of the majority? My books are true, yes. But people lose the whole point of the matter. It does not matter if I was born in Lhasa or Londonderry. The author does not matter. What the author writes does. Have these books helped you? Have they helped anyone? Has anything been learned from them? Yes? Then they are worthwhile. You, the reader, pay a few cents or a few pence for a paperback book. That minute sum does not automatically entitle you to set up as a prosecutor, a jury, judge, and executioner. Yet, that is what some of you are trying to do and actually loving it. But there it is. It's your choice what you believe. I say my books are true. Now, I do not claim that idly. I claim it because thousands of people have written to me and told me that my books have helped them, have stopped them from committing suicide, have helped relatives who were dying, have removed fear of death, etc., etc. Do you not think that in view of all of this, I am entitled to a little consideration, to a little politeness instead of the ranting press always hanging round my door? As you will read later, they eventually drove me away from Montreal. I'm going to quote from the Gazette of Montreal for Thursday, June 15th, 1972. The headline is, "Tibetans in Quebec are trying hard to keep tradition alive. Strangers in a promised land." We are going to be strangers for a long time, Lynn Bourgie murmured softly over the top of her teacup. She glanced quickly at her friend, Kasang Ishimorito, and smiled wistfully as she hunted for the right English expression. Kasang, at 22, is a shy, reticent girl with high cheekbones and an infectious grin, but she admits to a distrust of Montreal newspapers. When we first came here, a French paper wrote a story about us which said that we didn't even know what a swimming suit was and that we went swimming in our raincoats. We may be from another country, but we are not stupid. The story did not please Lynn much either. We never even saw the reporter who wrote the story, she said. Where is the truth in that? The press reporter or the Tibetan refugees? Yes, I certainly get to know all manner of strange things. For example, our old friend, Mr. John Henderson, of whom you've heard of in the past, sent me a cutting, and apparently I cannot quote much from it because my publisher thinks I should possibly be infringing someone else's copyright. And one has to please a publisher, doesn't one? Anyway, Mr. Henderson sent me a cutting from the Charlotte Observer, dated August 26, 1971, and the headlines are startling enough. They say, "Japanese say Jesus died, buried there at age 112. The story goes on. "Jesus not crucified. Documents. Japanese claim Christ sacrificed brother on the cross and then fled." The article is by John Justin Smith. Apparently the fellow is a reporter on the Charlotte Observer staff. But it would be quite interesting for some of you who live in the USA to get a hold of that paper and read all the details which are given there. They are very circumstantial details, very authentic reading. I have a very close friend in Japan, and this young lady, to whom this book is dedicated, made some inquiries for me, and, well, I strongly advise you to get a hold of that newspaper because some of you will find it really interesting. But I have to remember the exhortation and injunctions of Mr. Publisher, bless his soul. And so the best thing we can do now is to answer some more questions. I have some very good ones here. Yes, that's right, too. Some of these questions are quite good. For example, please, can you explain how art or other creative activities increase one's vibrations and how beneficial are such vibrations? Yes, actually everyone and everything, as I've told you before, consists of vibrations. There are negative vibrations and positive vibrations, and I do not know how many of you have ever played with tuning forks, but if you have had two tuning forks, you can hold one with its end on a table, and then you could bang on the other tuning fork to set it humming, and place that with its end on the table quite a distance away from the first tuning fork. And the first tuning fork will start humming in sympathy with the other one. Get hold of a pair of tuning forks from your music store. They're quite cheap enough. Try it and you'll find it is really quite interesting. When we get vibrations, which are pleasant, it makes us vibrate more pleasantly. That is, increases our rate of vibration and thus makes us happier, more spiritual, more perceptive. But if we get a thing which depresses our vibrations, then we get nasty-minded, lower spiritually, and it definitely stops spiritual progress. Painting, after all, is just a set of materials arranged in such a fashion that the entire vibration is such that it pleases us and it increases our rate of vibration. So art, whether it be a picture or music, can increase our spirituality by raising our vibration. Remember, high vibrations are good and positive, and low vibrations are negative and not always so good. The next question is a good one. It really does fit in with the question above. A lady writes, "This is a question so many people would, I believe, like some information on. Fear. You have described how fear is nothing more than uncontrolled imagination struggling with willpower, and that willpower will always fail in the struggle. What is the cause of fear?" Let's go back to art. If we see something beautiful, we appreciate it, we like it, we get pleasure from it. But if we see something terrible, what shall I say? A picture of devilish tortures, whatever it may be. If it is a terrible, beastly, horrible thing, it depresses our vibrations and we get to thinking, "Oh, suppose that should happen to me." Then, immediately, it sets up a chain reaction in our vibrationary makeup, and the unpleasant vibrations, which we call fear, feeds upon itself and produces more fear. You get the same thing sometimes when people pass a graveyard at midnight and something stirs. The hair on the back of their neck sticks up, and there's a great temptation to start off at a run, because the imagination lowers the vibrations so that one is susceptible to impressions from the lower astral of disembodied spirits, bodies in coffins and all the rest of it, and we think that such things could happen to us. We think that a ghost is going to come out and bite us behind or something like that. Well, we think about that and we fail to be rational about it, and so the fear grows and grows. In other words, the vibrations become lower and lower, and we become gloomier and gloomier. Fear is nothing but uncontrolled imagination. If you want to overcome fear, just be certain that nothing is going to hurt you. Nothing can hurt you. Tell yourself that you are an immortal soul, and although it is possible for someone to temporarily damage your clothes or your body, that will not hurt the essential you. The less you fear, the less you will have fear, so that in the end, you can discipline yourself so much that fear does not exist, cannot exist in your makeup. Then you will know contentment and satisfaction. Then you will walk with your head up and your shoulders back, unless you live in a wheelchair. Now, listen to this. You have described how drugs can do great harm to one's spirituality. Can such damage be repaired within a lifetime? And you say also that one should never take drugs, but surely you will agree that many people have secured out-of-body experiences by the use of drugs, or have secured spiritual enlightenment through the use of drugs. I believe you're wrong when you say that drugs are harmful. Now, what do you say about that? Yes, ma'am, I do say that drugs are wrong. I do say that drugs are the work of the devil himself, because if you take drugs, then you are altering your vibrations artificially, and you are making it almost impossible. And I did say almost. To develop spiritually without the aid of such props. Drugs are terrible things indeed, and they definitely stain your astral body and impair your physical body. Do you believe that athletes should be given drugs to make them run faster or jump higher? Do you believe that people should take benzodrine tablets to keep them going longer? If you do, you should read some of the police reports. For an illustration, I'll tell you about long-distance truck drivers. These men drive vast distances every day, and naturally they get tired. So, many of them have been in the habit of taking drugs, or as they term them, goofballs. And the police records and insurance statistics quite irrefutably prove that the use of these drugs causes accidents, death, and mental impairment. Now, if drug firms could do so with safety, they would sell all manner of drugs. They're in the business to make money, but it is stupid to go on selling stuff like LSD, goofballs, and the like, and then find that they are injuring the health of so many people. I say, drugs should be quite definitely banned. But those who have taken drugs, what hope have they? They have every hope, provided they most rigidly abstain from taking drugs anymore, provided they eat sensibly and drink sensibly, and provided they do not go in for too many forms of abuse, self-abuse, that is. No one is beyond the pale. Everyone can be helped if they want to be helped. So, if any of you who are drug addicts really want to kick the habit, then you can kick the habit, and by the time you get to the other side, you'll find that your astral form has recovered from the psychic shock of your physical drug addiction. I do want to say something here about suicide, because of late I have been shocked at the number of people who've written to me saying that they've been on drugs and they see no way out except to commit suicide. Well, my goodness me, suicide is very, very wrong indeed. You harm yourself, and you have to come back to much worse conditions if you commit suicide. If you have difficulties which make you think about suicide, then talk over the matter with a priest or even with the Salvation Army, or look in the telephone directory and find some association or society connected with welfare with whom you can discuss your problems. So let me emphasize, as I have emphasized so often in the past, never contemplate suicide. Never commit suicide. You are hurting yourself if you do. If you commit suicide, well, you have abandoned help. If you stay alive, there's always some way out of your problem. Suicide is not a way out because, I repeat, you come back to harder conditions. And now, another question. How is it that some people come to one sign of the zodiac and some to another sign? If we come as a Taurus person, how can we appreciate the problems of a Cancer person, or a Leo person, or a Scorpio person, or something else? I don't understand this problem about how we come under different signs of the zodiac. Will you tell us? Yes, I can tell you. Every person goes through every sign of the zodiac, and there are 12 signs. And every person has to live through each quadrant of the zodiac. So you can be just entering the sign of Libra in one life, and then in another life, but not necessarily the next. You can be right midway in the sign of Libra, and yet in another life you can be just leaving the sign of Libra, or of course all the other signs of the zodiac. So you have to live through every sign and every part of the sign so that you get full experience of each of the signs. Question. Tell us about the future. Are we, in the West, all going to be in for it, or will things suddenly brighten for us? Tell us, will you? I've just bought a place up in the Rockies in Washington State. I'm having a house built there, and I'm hoping to be free of all troubles. Will I be? Well, we have to remember that everything comes in cycles. Imagine that you are watching a great big pendulum. The pendulum is at the top of its stroke. Let us say you are facing this pendulum and it's at the top of its stroke on the right-hand side. Then you release it, and it moves down, and eventually it reaches its lowest point, and then it rises to go up to its highest point. Then it reverses and comes down again to the lowest point and up again. Life, all existence, is like that. So you get a golden age, and then people are too self-satisfied, so things get worse and worse. things get lower and lower, just like the pendulum on its downward swing. And then, when it's nearly at the bottom of its swing, you get the negation of all liberties. You get communism when people get horribly sick of being dictated to. After that, they strive again for freedom. And so, just as the pendulum moved to the upward stroke, people strive for more spirituality, and they work hard at it. They put aside their petty bickering. They put aside their fighting. Conditions improve. Eventually, life becomes quite pleasant, and then it becomes exceedingly good, better and better. And so we come again to a golden age, an age in which people get complacent, too self-satisfied, too content. They sit back. They've got everything. There's nothing more to work for. And then the pendulum starts on its downward swing again. And so, people find hardship coming. They find communism coming again. And we get the same thing, cycle after cycle. Now, upon this earth, we're having a hard time. The pendulum is still going down, and it has to go down still further before we can go higher. But cheer up, the communism the world will know will not be so severe as that which initiated that evil cult or policy into this world, because each time conditions get a little better. So, we are approaching the darkest hour before the dawn, but after the darkest hour, shafts of light will shine across the sky, the gloom will end, the day will dawn, and again we shall come to the golden age. But at the end of the day, the night will fall again, to be followed by gloom and darkness, until again dawn will burst upon the world, and life will become brighter and brighter, until, with increasing complacency and self-satisfaction, conditions will deteriorate. And so, until the end of time, the earth and all worlds will have these cycles of good and bad. So be of good cheer, because no one is ever alone or deserted. There is always hope. So keep that in mind. You can be as good as you want to be. You can be helped at any time if you really want to be. End of chapter 4.